Before the Russians arrived, Nazino Island was a beautiful, peaceful place. Or if not beautiful, the swampy Siberian island at least wasn't something out of Dante's Nine Circles of Hell. The Ostiak ethnic group, an indigenous people of Siberia, had lived in the harsh climate since at least the 16th century when the name first started to appear in official Russian records. They almost certainly had been living there for quite some time before appearing in official records, and they would continue to live there into the 20th century. As one elderly peasant woman would recall in 1989, "We were living in Ergankina. Every spring, we left for the island of Nazino to harvest the poplar bark that we sent downstream. It was our only source of income. The whole family went along, and we took enough food to spend the season there." In the 1930s, any peaceful harvesting on this island would be interrupted by a campaign on the part of Russia's communist government, the Soviet Union's communist government, to send away hundreds of thousands of kulaks, land-owning peasant farmers who did not love handing their hard-earned and hard-worked farms over to the communists. People who didn't fit into Stalin's idea of what an industrial, worker-led society should look like. To achieve control over Russia's major cities and institute a brutally repressive surveillance state after tens of thousands of these peasants had fled the countryside into urban areas following the state's seizure of their farmland, the Soviet government would plan to send these displaced and disenfranchised peoples to the outer reaches of Russia to sustain the Soviet Union's rapidly industrializing economy. Except, there was no real plan for how to do this that was even remotely humane. Everything was hastily cobbled together. People were quickly kidnapped and arrested, moved and placed into holding camps, places that had no provisions, no capacity to handle the thousands of people who had no fucking idea why they had been detained and what was going on. And then many of these people were unceremoniously dumped onto an island, a very cold, completely undeveloped island. Deportees began to arrive on the island of Nazino in May of 1933, an area initially intended to hold them only briefly, but would be, for many, their final resting place. Their only food was some bags of raw flour. There was no fresh water, only contaminated river water. There were no shelters, only the harsh Siberian winter. If desperation was the goal, there would have been no better place to induce it. And when people get desperate, they'll eat whatever or whoever they need to survive.
Words and ideas can change the world.
I hated her, but I wanted to love my mother.
I have a dream.
I'll plead not guilty right now.
Your only chance is to leave with us.
In early February of 1933, Gendrik Yagoda, the head of the OGPU, the Secret Police and Intelligence Service of the Soviet Union at this time, and Mativ Berman, the head of the Gulag system of labor camps maintained in the Soviet Union from 1930 to 1955, jointly presented Soviet dictator, huge piece of shit, Joseph Stalin, with a vast plan for deporting millions of anti-Soviet elements in the cities and the countryside to Western Siberia and Kazakhstan. The previous 3 years had seen the deportation of over 2 million kulaks, aka prosperous peasants and their families. And now the men thought it was time to move into a new, much more extensive effort to deport, quote, all elements polluting the socialist society currently being constructed. They decided to target six categories of people. One, kulaks who had not been yet de-kulaksized in the preceding years. Two, peasants who were, quote, sabotaging the state's procurement plans and other politico-economic campaigns undertaken by the state. Holy propaganda. Three, kulaks who are hiding in farms and workplaces or escaping from the countryside. Four, individuals expelled in the context of cleaning up in the USSR's western frontiers. Five, urban elements refusing to leave cities in the context of passportization. Six, individuals whom the courts and the OGPU's special jurisdictions have sentenced to terms of less than 5 years, with the exceptions of, quote, elements particularly dangerous from a social point of view. Okay. The plan was simple. All of these elements would be deported as labor colonists. That's a nice word for slave, with the same status as the kulaks deported between 1930 and 1931. They would be deprived of their civil rights, put under house arrest in a labor village, put to special use within state economic structures, mostly in brutal fields of timber, mining, and farming. According to the plan, about three quarters of these labor colonists, what they estimated to be about 1.5 million people, would work on farms and in the forest. Within 2 years, they were supposed to have, quote, freed the state from any expense for their support and begun producing merchandise that would allow the state to recover the expenses incurred in the operations of deportation and settlement of the contingents. Holy shit. So in essence, you know, they would pay off their deportation over 2 years of hard labor. Deportation that they wanted no part of. Fucking can you imagine? Can you imagine being kidnapped, sent off to Siberia and be like, hey, we're going to have to leave you out here for a couple years so you can pay off the expense, you know, that we had to pay to get you out here. I never wanted to. Shut the fuck up. That's basically what it was. The rest, about 500,000 people, would work in fishing, crafts, and mining, while at the same time conducting a small side operation. This is a quote, too, from the Soviets. While at the same time conducting a small side operation in order to feed themselves. They had a side hustle so they didn't starve. This was called deportation colonization and had been part of the Soviet plan since the Russian Revolution. Back in November of 1917, at a meeting of delegates of the Committees of Poor Peasants, oh, their stupid fucking names in the Soviet Union, Vladimir Lenin announced a new policy to eliminate what were believed to be wealthy Soviet peasants, aka kulaks. If the kulaks remain untouched, he said, if we don't defeat the freeloaders, the czar and the capitalist will inevitably return. Oh, man, they should have returned. It was fucking way better under the czars than it was under the Soviets. Kulaks were thought to be more sympathetic to a monarchistic or capitalistic upper class, and thus under communism, you know, they had to be eliminated. And given that the royal family had been deposed and murdered, and there was now no longer a scapegoat for the Russian Revolution to run on, the kulaks, they made a great new scapegoat for this regime. In July of 1918, committees of the poor were created to represent poor peasants, which played an important role in the actions against the kulaks and led the process of redistribution of confiscated lands, inventory, and food surpluses from the kulaks. This launched the beginning of a great crusade against grain speculators and kulaks. Before it would be dismissed in December of 1918, the committees of the poor confiscated roughly 50 million hectares of kulak land. Just stole it. And this would prove to be a lasting political tool. Lenin's successor, Joseph Stalin, announced the, quote, liquidation of the kulaks as a class, December 27th, 1929. Now we have the opportunity to carry out a resolute offensive against the kulaks, break their resistance, eliminate them as a class, and replace their production with the production of kulkases and sovkases. He said those last two terms referring to collective farms and state-owned farms. The Politburo of the All-Union Communist Party formalized Stalin's decision in a resolution titled On Measures for the Elimination of Kulaks Households in Districts of Comprehensive Collectivization. On January 30th, 1930. All kulaks were now in one of three categories. One, those to be shot or imprisoned as decided by local secret police. That's awesome. Two, those to be sent to Siberia, the North, the Urals, or Kazakhstan after confiscation of their property. These guys were just fucked. Three, those who would be evicted from their houses and used in forced labor colonies. And all this because, you know, these assholes had the audacity to work hard enough to save up enough money to buy their own farms and then work them before the Bolshevik Revolution. These people were not exploitive nobles. They were not treacherous land barons. They were just farmers. And this is how the Soviets treated them. They othered them, made the landless poor think that they were the enemies when the Communist Party was the enemy of everyone. But why send them to Siberia or anywhere else? Why not just kill them all if they were enemies of the state? Well, the answer to that question goes back to the Russian Revolution. You see, at the time that the Bolsheviks were taking power back in 1917, Russia was not quite capitalist enough to become fully communist, at least in a Marxian sense. I know that sounds contradictory. Let me explain. Most Russians were peasants tending the land of large landlords. Until relatively recently, many of these peasants had been serfs, a not-so-free peasant-type person, obligated to work for their lord, who could be sold similar to a slave. Practice only outlawed in 1861, by which actually slowly phased out over the decades that followed. This meant that there simply wasn't enough sites of heavy industry, places like factories, mines, and mills, to support the new communist working class. Without those heavy industries, all they would have was a shit ton of farmland, and their lives would basically be the same as they were before. Then there was the fact that Karl Marx argued that only through a modern industrialized economy could a true proletariat class be developed. So in order to become truly communist, a lot of factories needed to be built, and a lot of farmers needed to become factory workers, whether they wanted to or not. The Soviet Union had another more practical need for industry. Stalin wanted to develop heavy industries like coal, oil, and steel because he feared that the capitalist West would invade the USSR. He presented the need to industrialize as a life or death struggle. "Do you want our socialist fatherland to be beaten and to lose its independence?" he asked in February 1931 in a speech. At the outset of Stalin's first five-year plan in 1929, a plan that intended to pave the way for rapid industrialization, the formation of a new national identity, and pretty much the complete takeover of Russian society, politics, and the economy, Stalin instituted impossibly high production figures for factories to stir up enthusiasm and national pride. But if he wanted people to work in factories and not tend to the land, he also had to find a way to feed them, which meant he had to tend the land. Quite the catch-22. Enter the kulaks, doing double duty as both scapegoat and communist Russia's food source. They're put in a really weird spot here. Party activists helped the state political directorate, the secret police, deport 1,803,392 of these people to labor colonies and camps in just 1930 and 1931. The peasantry was also required to relinquish their farm animals to government authorities, but most of them ended up slaughtering them first, eating the meat, hiding what they couldn't eat. Peasants would also try to hide grain. Peasants who did not show signs of literal starvation were suspected of hiding food. And then the communists forced them to give up their grain stocks, essentially their seed stocks, or what they would use to plant grain the following year. And that led to a massive famine between 1930 and 1933 that would end up killing between 5.7 and 8.7 million people. And that's the kind of shit that happens when you put appointed fucking idiots in charge of areas where expertise is actually needed and important. See some of that going on today. And so now in February of 1933, Yagoda and Berman hand over their plan to deport 2 million kulaks based on their, quote, success. The plan went like this. To ensure the success of this deportation colonization, 1,000 labor villages at the rate of one village for every 2,000 elements, or about 500 families, would be hastily built. Each village would consist of 100 living units of 650 square feet each, sheltering 20 people, each deportee thus being allotted 27 square feet of living space. A little over 5 feet by 5 feet of living space per person, smaller than a prison cell. During the first year, baths, an infirmary, a hygienic station for removing lice and other parasites, stables and a garage for machinery were to be constructed. During the second year, a school, a cafeteria, a reading room, a store, and so on were to be constructed. For the construction of these labor villages, the managers of the OGPU and the Gulag estimated that they would need 3,385,000 cubic meters of wood, 10,288 metric tons of iron and sheet metal, 6,929 metric tons of nails, 2,591 square meters of glass, and other materials. And you'd need a whole administrative department, police force, and economic management system for all this. But now the problem was, how the fuck were they supposed to get all of that out to the middle of nowhere? The report acknowledged that this was a problem because the whole point of the deportation colonization was to populate the furthest reaches of the USSR. They estimated they would need about 2,416 trucks, 90,000 horses, and 1,200 tractors to get everybody out there before work on the settlement could even begin. Thus, the report concluded with a long list of expenses that Yagoda and Berman expected Daddy Stalin to pay, expenses amounting to almost 1.4 million rubles. There was just one problem with that. Unlike before, when the beginnings of the famine were so localized, the USSR was now in the middle of a nationwide famine because the Soviets were fucking idiots and there was a huge resource shortage. But the USSR didn't want to admit that they didn't have the resources to fight their kulak enemies and provide for the communist people of Russia via what was essentially slave labor, because that would make them look weak. And so the new plan was approved by the Council of People's Commissars on March 11, 1933, and after a month of bargaining, they agreed to settle 28,000 deportees during the winter, and then 250,000 to 275,000 over the whole of 1933 in Western Siberia. The OGPU's representative in Western Siberia, listed in sources by the sole name of Alexeyev, who was the regional head of the political police there, would be informed that 1 million people would arrive between winter and summer of this year to be settled as far as possible from any railway in case the kulaks either tried to escape or tried to join up with each other and mount a resistance. So a much bigger number overall there than the 250 to 275,000. So I guess 1 million over a year's worth of time, 275,000, you know, by the end of 1933. Soon this plan would be underway. At first, many of this round of this first round of, or this current round, excuse me, of deportees were people from Moscow, Leningrad, other cities who had been unable to obtain internal passports. Part of this passportization, I fucking hate the communists, the way they talk about shit. They literally just make up words. The fucking Soviets who just like, here's a fucking word combo that sounds cool. That's just complete nonsense. The passportization campaign had begun in 1932 to issue internal passports to all residents of major cities, with one of their objectives being to cleanse Moscow, Leningrad, and other great urban centers of the USSR of superfluous elements not connected with production or administrative work, as well as kulaks, criminals, and other antisocial and socially dangerous elements, according to a 1932 Politburo document. What they were really trying to do was just punish people, not just landowners, but non-landowners as well, punish people who were leaving the countryside because of all the land that was being seized, and people who were being brutalized, and even those who were not in the bourgeoisie were like, fuck this, but millions of people arriving in cities threatened the whole urban rationing system that had begun laboriously set up beginning in 1929. Back then, some 26 million city dwellers were among those participating in the rationing system. By the end of 1930, that rose to almost 40 million. So in other words, Stalin had a lot of mouths to feed. Stalin said he was deporting people to punish them for leaving the countryside and abandoning the communist mission. But the real obvious reason was he did not have the means to feed all these people who were fleeing the countryside and heading to the cities, fleeing the countryside because of his own fucking stupid policies. So he creates a problem, and then that problem leads to an even worse problem. And now he fixes that by just punishing these people who have already been punished. You know, he didn't have the means to feed people because his ignorant and haphazard political directives were destroying Russian society. And before we explore Stalin's horror any further, time for this week's first of two Mitchell sponsor breaks. If you don't want to hear these ads, please sign up to be a Space Lizard on Patreon. Get the catalog ad-free, get these episodes early, and more. Thanks for listening to those ads. And now let's return to examine Stalin's cruel deportation plan, that culminated in what was essentially the death camp of Nazino Island. The deportees would be a varied group. Merchants and traders, peasants who had fled the countryside, and anyone who didn't generally fit into the idealized worker class structure. You know, it could just be somebody who went out to buy cigarettes or snacks without their passport and were unlucky enough to get arrested. That would amount to a lot of people. Between March and July of 1933, 85,937 people living in Moscow alone were arrested. Almost 90,000 people arrested, deported, because they lacked passports, while 4,776 people living in Leningrad were similarly deported. In accordance with this plan, the deportees would pass through three transit camps at Tomsk, Omsk, and Achinsk. These transit camps had been opened in 1930, 1931, in connection with the first two waves of dekulakization in large open spaces between the freight stations and the rivers. Since autumn of 1931, however, these camps had no longer been in use, and the hastily constructed huts had fallen into ruin. On assuming his office, on March 19th, 1933, the head of the Tomsk transit camp, Gorgi Kuznetsov, stated that the camp consisted of, quote, a single rundown hut dating from 1930. All the other huts half demolished were unsuitable for housing anyone. So this program is off to a great start. This is so very Soviet. This is so very like a bunch of dipshits getting to a fucking, you know, poorly painted, poorly lit boardroom, wearing their fucking stupid, you know, military uniforms when most of them had not even fought in the military. And, you know, just a bunch of old dickheads. And they're like, well, that's what we need to do. And they were just something that just, you know, like sounded like it would please Stalin. He'd be like, excellent. We can get rid of 2 million. Do it. And then they would just, you know, give that directive to some lesser bureaucrat. It's like, what? This is insane. This is impossible. But they can't say that or they'll be fucking killed. Or at least, you know, kicked out of the party, sent off to a gulag or something somewhere. So now they got to fucking try and do the impossible. And it just leads to just nonsense like this. just something that should have never, ever happened. It was just stupid from the very beginning. Authorities planned to build huts and shelter others in tents, but construction could not be completed before May 1st. So they wrote back to central authorities to say that the convoys, maybe they should hold off. Maybe they shouldn't arrive until like, you know, mid-May or so at the very, very earliest. But then, you know, other Soviets, they have their orders and they're like, nope, that's impossible. And the convoy arrived in April and it arrived to a wasteland. And authorities who had no idea how many people were coming, what shape they would be in, what they needed, are just trying to like deal with this mess now. There was no food supply system for the camps, like none at all. Within 3 weeks, from April 9th to April 30th, more than 25,000 people arrived from Ukraine, the North Caucasus, the Volga regions, the Black Sea, from Moscow and Leningrad. They were already starving, most of them. Authorities wrote that many of the people who arrived there were no more than, quote, semi-cadavers. And there were only about 40 beds in the infirmary. So that's cool. We got thousands and thousands and thousands of people that are semi-cadavers, and we got 40 beds. A report by Vasily Arsenyevich Velichko, the local Communist Party head in Narimsky, the district of the West Siberian Krai, would describe some of the deportees that he saw, like Gursova, saying, quote, writing, quote, an old woman, her husband is an old communist, chief officer of the Murom railway station, who has worked there 23 years. Her son works there as an apprentice engine driver. Gorseva came to Moscow to buy a suit for her husband and some white bread. Her documents did not help her. So she went out to get some bread and got fucking napped. There was also Voykin. And then it's, for some reason, his last couple, middle name and last name are abbreviated to just Nick and Voss. A communist youth organization member since 1929. Worker of the plant, red textile worker in Serpukhov, awarded bonuses thrice. At his weekend, headed to a football match. Passport had been left at home, apprehended. So this is like a dude who is a dedicated communist, fucking awarded bonuses, and he goes out to watch a soccer game, forgot his passport at home, and he gets napped. I mean, imagine doing something as innocuous as just forgetting to grab your driver's license when you leave your apartment, and then some Soviet equivalent of an ice goon grabs you, throws you into a fucking, you know, equivalent of a van, and you end up on a fucking road to Siberia. There were whole families that had been rounded up, like M. Yerofimovich. I love that all these people have super long names. Thank you very much. It's great. 32 years old, deported with his wife and 9-year-old daughter because he had sold tobacco illegally in 1931. Oh, what a hardened criminal. Get that tobacco seller off the streets. Not even being a party member or being related to one could save you. There was the case of Peter Saul, 51 years old, a, quote, tailor deported from Sochi. His daughter and son-in-law are party members and are in the diplomatic service abroad, deported because he owned his house. Jesus, how dare he own a house? Sometimes you got deported because of something as simple as providing for your family, as in the case of Natalia Barabanova, who was arrested during a roundup in Sochi, in a Sochi, like, basically a supermarket. She has to be allowed to go home, or at least to take her children, including an infant. Nope, they didn't let her do that. People thought she was arrested for having bought a kilo of dolphin fat from some shady character at the market. She tried to buy something she wasn't supposed to, so fuck her forever. And based on the comments I see online on a lot of posts today, I see people still rationalizing horrible, inhumane acts with that simplistic rationale of, well, it was illegal, so they shouldn't have done it. So fuck them. What if that type of person would sign off on, like, police executing jaywalkers or having the hands cut off of kids who shoplift candy? I mean, you know, they committed crimes. If they wanted to keep their hands, they should have bought that candy. If they wanted to keep their heads, well, they should use a crosswalk. I feel like there's always been those idiots in the world. Just, like, very black and white thinkers, just no nuance. Are they just fucking stupid or cruel? Or both? I constantly wonder. Is there just a lot of fucking idiots in the world? I don't want to think that, but it seems so true so often the time. I'm like, God, the world is full of so many fucking morons. Sometimes it didn't even fucking matter why you got deported, as in the case of Maria Lavrikova, 35 years old, a, quote, waitress in the Riviera Hotel in Sochi. According to her statements, her husband is a battalion commander in Amur province, holds 2 red flag decorations, deported with her father, age 71, her mother, age 70, and a brother, age 22, reasons unknown. You know, who fucking cares that her husband is a decorated commander You know, some goons felt like grabbing her, so they did. Whatever, fill a quota. A. Popova, 30 years old, was, quote, arrested in the Tuapse train station where she'd gone to meet her niece. Popova works in the port, cannot in any way be considered a parasitical element. But fuck her for, I don't know, being a good aunt. If she didn't want to get deported, she shouldn't have grabbed her niece, right? She shouldn't have went to give fucking, I don't know, candy to her niece or just give her a hug and tell her she's cool or something. A lot of people died in transit, including the 5-year-old brother of 18-year-old Yevgeny Markovkina, who was deported with her siblings because her father, who had died in 1931, had been a, quote, shady operator in the past, whatever that means. That sounds like just some bullshit. Like when you can't think of like a real good reason to do something bad to somebody. Oh, hey, nah, she's shady. Or at least her dad is. Oh, yeah. Her dad's shady as shit. What did he do? Shady stuff. Stop asking questions. Nobody was authorized to leave the convoy when the 5-year-old died, so his body was simply and coldly thrown out of a fucking window. That's cool. More than 500 deportees would die during the days following their arrival. Over the course of the next 2 months, May and June of 1933, another 1,700 deportees would die, a majority of them, quote, as a result of the general weakening of the organism. And that's Soviet speak for starvation. Of course, only the fucking Soviets would write that way, would explain somebody starving to death that way. Did they starve to death? Yes. They died as a result of a general weakening of the organism. Can't you just say they starved? That is what I said. I said the general weakening of the organism. Fucking cult. But this first convoy, not the only ones who would suffer there. During the summer of 1932, massive arrest campaigns had overloaded the prisons, reaching 800,000 people incarcerated in the spring of 1932. February of 1933, Nikolai Krylenko, the People's Commissar of the Justice Department, proposed to decongest the prisons and to settle several hundred thousand inmates in these new labor villages. At the beginning of March 1933, the Politburo approved Krylenko's proposal. A rail convoy holding criminal deportees left Moscow April 30th, and a similar convoy left Leningrad on April 29th, with both arriving at Tomsk May 10th, saturating the Tomsk camp, already overloaded, with more than 6,000 extra people, many of them suffering from syphilis, and most between 16 and 30 years old. And these criminals, by the way, not criminals in a significant way. Mainly, it sounds like crimes due to circumstance. They'd mainly been convicted of theft, hooliganism. That sounds like some more bullshit. Like, if you just don't like somebody, you want to throw them in jail. What'd they do? Ah, they were hooliganing. They were hooliganing it up. Damn hooligans. Did stuff like resold products that were in short supply, received stolen goods. And, you know, a quote-unquote stolen good could just be some food that wasn't authorized by the Soviets. Other kinds of trafficking often engaged in by people who are fucking starving thanks to unjust governmental policies. These people were criminals in the same way that some starving Palestinian kid in Gaza who shoplifts to try and keep himself alive is technically a criminal. They were also different from the other deportees in that they were already hardened from prison life. Most used to doing bad deeds out of desperation. They didn't have family members that they needed to protect or take care of. They're only out for themselves. And also, again, they were starving. The daily food ration during the trip was 300 grams, around 11 ounces of bread per person, which meant upon arriving at Tomsk that these criminal groups immediately began beating the non-criminal city dwellers and stealing their food and clothing. Right? Desperate times. And then they were all stuck there. The rivers were not navigable, as chunks of ice made traveling impossible, and even if they had been, none of the barges meant to transport the deportees had arrived, meaning none of these people could be relocated as planned. Instead, Moscow now ordered more checks of the convoys to figure out who they were, what their papers said, their reason for deportation. Historians assume this is because family members of prominent party members were deported and those party members had complained. And these checks found that up to 20% of the deportees were, quote, individuals completely unsuited for labor, old, invalid, simple-minded, or blind. My God. One of five of these people are elderly and or physically disabled and or mentally disabled and or blind. Authorities concluded that this was because the roundups had occurred at public places like train stations, markets, and get this, hospices. Fucking hospices. That's wild. They kidnapped elderly people just, you know, looking for a place to die in peace. Just some soulless following orders, you know, bullshit. This was not about labor or industrialization at all. This was about getting rid of mouths to feed. Mouths that Stalin did not value. One of these mouths was Mark Peravatlov. Peravalov, 103 years old. Yes, he was 103 years old. And he was, quote, deported in the convoy from Pyatigorsk. It proved impossible to determine his biography and the circumstances in which he had been taken away because he's unable to stand up, completely decrepit, does not speak. Jesus. They fucking just put a skeleton on this convoy. There was also Evdokia Kotelnikova, 85 years old. Quote, without family, cannot stand up, half naked, bedridden. This is actually a quote describing her too in the official documents. A decomposing semi-cadaver, unable to speak or move. This is truly some evil shit. There was also Elizabeta Zola Tareva. Fuck me. Tareva? Zola Tareva! 85 years old, without family, unable to move about on her own, was expelled from Kislovodsk on the pretext that she was a former owner of a factory and a prostitute. Oh, totally. Yeah, we gotta get this 85-year-old prostitute out of here. My God. Love how communist leaders decided that anybody who owned something was evil, by the way. And now they damn near owned everything. There was also Miron Korotenko, 76 years old, and his wife, 75 years old, both, quote, deported from, my God, these words, Mineralnaya Vody. Fucking Soviet small towns. Awesome. 90% invalid. Reason, deprived of their civil rights. Simulator parasites, refusing to work on the collective farm. Oh, boy. I wonder if they refused to work on the farm because they were 90% invalid and in their mid-70s. Authorities weren't too worried about these people causing trouble during their death deportations because they were, most of them sounds like nearly dead already. But the prisoners being deported, you know, those people stealing food and stuff to feed themselves, they worried the authorities at Tomsk. They seemed like the types of people who might head out to Western Siberia, maybe recruit people to their cause, maybe mount a rebellion. Or simply sow some chaos. Real fucking deviants. So it was decided that these people would be divided up amongst the city dwellers and sent to the furthest, least accessible areas that were already far away. Local authorities near Nazino Island were informed on May 5th that 5,000 such deportees were on their way. Like the authorities at Tomsk, they had no place to put these deportees. They had no supplies at all to give them, no food to feed them. Their own supplies had almost run out because the river had been frozen over since October. Indeed, the authorities only had 30 pairs of men's trousers, 6 sheets of tin, enough to make about 2 dozen buckets for them to shit in, and a few hundred pairs of hemp boots. They wrote back saying that it would be weeks at the earliest before they were ready to take anybody at all, but they knew as well as anybody that once Moscow made up its mind, the deal was done. For better or for worse, and usually for worse. So 5,000 deportees left for the island on 4 river barges on May 14th, with about a third of them being, quote, criminals from the prisons. And now before we find out what is in store for these poor bastards on the island, time for today's second of 2 sponsor breaks. Thanks for listening to those sponsors. Now let's return to find out what happens in hell on Nazino Island. The deportees were kept below decks on the barges as they traveled to the island and apparently fed a daily ration of 200 grams or 7 ounces of bread per person per day. So about 7 slices of bread a day. No meat, no fruit, no veggies, no vitamins, no medicine. A lot of these people desperately needed. 20 tons of flour, though, were also transported. But the barges contained no other food, cooking utensils, or tools. Just a fucking shit ton of flour outside of that bread. 4 kilos a person would last about 10 days, but only if the flour was, you know, made into bread, which it wasn't, which it couldn't be because they didn't have tools. They didn't have ovens. During the afternoon of May 18th, the barges unloaded their passengers on Nazino, which had been chosen as an interim point, while authorities made preparations for a more permanent settlement elsewhere, seem like a good choice because they could be taken in small groups off the island by boat to the furthest reaches of Western Siberia, where they wouldn't be able to coordinate with each other, would have no choice but to toil for the communist regime or die. The 322 women and 4,556 men, oh my God, these poor women, who disembarked on May 18th, could observe a swampy island about 3 kilometers or almost 2 miles long and just 660 yards wide. Nowhere near enough space to support this many people. And the island had no shelters, no sewage system, no wells, nothing. Fortunately or unfortunately, the number of people about to be dumped there already getting smaller. 27 bodies were brought ashore, having perished on the journey. Over a third of the deportees were already too weak to stand up at this point. Over a third. Many of them elderly. The deportees struggled to shore with 50 or so guards, including the two newly recruited commanders. Until nightfall, the commanders tried to count the deportees and perform a roll call. But the list they had were largely illegible, had the wrong names, wrong number of total people. Finally, with the boat captain threatening that he wanted to be paid for an extra day if he had to stay the night, they just counted up the number of men and women, you know, like approximately, and just call it a day. Who cares if they should be here or not? Once the deportees had been set down on the island, Commander Sepkov ordered the 20 tons of flour to be unloaded, and then a fight broke out. While sacks of flour were being unloaded and the guards opened fire, they wounded, i.e. shot, several people who would not receive any medical attention. After that incident, Sepkov ordered the convoy to cast off and unload the stocks of the flour on the other side of the river, where they would be protected from any, quote, attack. But they would not be protected from the damp and the cold. In fact, because there were not enough sacks, a product always in short supply in the fucking shithole that was the Soviet Union, a large portion of the flour loaded on the barges had been directly poured onto sandbags that were now poured out directly onto the ground. The local inhabitants were stupefied by this abundance, which was soon covered with snow. For a few hours after the boats were unloaded, a snowstorm set in. The deportees began to light wood fires in the hopes of warming themselves. By the next morning, the island was a blanket of snow and ash. Sepkov, accompanied by his assistants, the three health officers, and the two new commanders who had arrived from Tomsk, tried to organize an initial distribution of flour at the rate of a pound a person. Most of the deportees, well, they didn't have cups, they didn't have tumblers, they didn't have any container at all to hold their precious ration in. So they would just hold out their hands or hold out like a shoe or like bundle up a coat. And that would be how they would grab their flour that they had fucking no ability to do anything to. What the fuck? They're just literally dumping cups of flour into people's shoes on an island with nothing on it. A frozen, barren island. It would have been so much kinder just to fucking gun them all down with machine guns. After 2 hours, this distribution degenerated into a disorderly scramble. Dozens of deportees were trampled. The guards opened fire again. They shot several more people who, again, would not receive medical attention. So Sepkov now decided to institute some new rules. Now the distribution would be made by so-called brigadiers. A bunch of ruthless or perhaps desperate deportees immediately monopolized the available brigadier positions, and they stole the flowers. Stole the flour. Meanwhile, dead bodies really starting to pile up. Now about 100 people have died, while many others have been reduced to moaning, crawling around on the ground, begging commanders to give them some actual bread. And then deportees start to eat each other. The authorities tried to mobilize, tried to set up shelters, to construct ovens, take ovens from homes of nearby inhabitants. Sepkov wanted to see what food he could find in a nearby village. He handed over authority of the island to two commanders and then left, but he wouldn't be able to find what he needed. The area is so fucking desolate, and the situation grows even worse. The deportees, they had started mixing river water, the only water they had access to, with their pound of flour a day, into just like fucking mush they were trying to choke down. They're also just straight up drinking this water, you know, because they got to drink something, and now they get dysentery. So now they're shitting their brains out, they're throwing up, they're fucking dehydrated, they're starving. Also, many of them never even got any flour, right, because it was stolen, again, like by the brigadiers, or by the guards, or by other deportees. To try and get rations, weaker deportees started to trade their clothing, their coats, their shoes, whatever they had, for any kind of food. A pair of shoes was soon worth 3 1-kilo loaves of bread or 5 salted fish. Somehow some guards are getting some shit in besides just flour, the island. I'm sure they're just fucking taking advantage of these people, robbing them, you know, with what they charge for it. An overcoat could be exchanged for a 2-kilo loaf of bread, a package of tobacco, one or two golden dental crowns. If you made one of these trades, you might enjoy your overcoat for a little while, you know, but then you probably have to trade it back to somebody else for bread once you started starving. As early as May 23rd, people were extracting gold crowns from the jawbones of cadavers to give those to the guards or other deportees for food. As more and more people die, this turns into a regular business. Meanwhile, the guards do not hesitate to execute those who, quote, cheat during the distribution of food. So if you manage to sell a piece of bread for an overcoat, you could quickly find yourself attacked or shot dead. Two sub-commanders, Chikalev and Sulia Manov, committed their share of atrocities as well, along with Vlysenko, the commander of the Nizhino village. They would inflict, according to a report, quote, blows and injuries on special settlers, systematic non-distribution of provisions, and deportees who did not know how to swim were thrown overboard, like of the barges, and drowned. These people were truly living in hell. Sarapkin, commander of the nearby village of Proletarka, quote, amused himself by having special settlers row the boats. Those who rowed badly were just thrown into the water. Several deportees drowned this way. So they're just killing people to amuse themselves. Sub-commander, Sulyamanov was especially harsh, ostentatiously eating huge quantities of sugar in front of starving deportees and announcing he had had so much sugar that he had lost his taste for it. What a sadist. When the deportees tried to escape the island on small primitive rafts, they were shot, according to Sepkov's orders. Some of them, though, they got away, but they mistakenly believed that there was a nearby railway station. Most drowned or died of hunger on the way there. By the summer, authorities would see hundreds of dead bodies washed up on the shores of the Ob River. But soon, all anybody would really see was the cannibalism. Rumors had started the day after the deportees arrived on the Nizhino. And on May 23rd, physicians wrote that people had succumbed to eating fellow deportees. In five cases, they wrote, quote, the liver, the heart, the lungs, and fleshy parts of the bodies, breasts, calves, had been cut off. On one of the bodies, the head had been torn off, along with the male genital organs and part of the skin. These mutilations constitute strong evidence of cannibalistic acts. Yeah, you think? In addition, they suggest the existence of serious psychopathologies. Yeah, of course. On the same day, May 21st, the deportees themselves brought us three individuals who had been caught with blood in their hands and holding human livers. Our examination of these three individuals did not reveal any extreme emaciation, but rather external signs of degeneracy. These individuals were immediately turned over to the head of the guard. Oh, totally. What? They weren't doing this because they were starving. They were doing it because they were just degenerates. These damn landowners. These people who dared fucking leave their houses without their passports. Over the course of the following weeks, the same health officials submitted three additional reports describing similar cases. In all, quote, several dozen bodies found with the liver, heart, and lungs cut out. According to these reports, the guards made no attempt to isolate the individuals who were caught in possession of human flesh or in the act of eating it, since it could not be clear if they had killed the person whose body parts they were eating. And cannibalism was not necessarily against the Soviet legal code. That's great. You can easily have your life destroyed over leaving your apartment to go to a soccer match without your fucking ID. But cannibalism, oh, that's fine. That's totally fine. We don't have a law for that. But murder would soon be provable and the authorities would decide that they had to do something. Another convoy would arrive May 27th of about 1,200 people, straining the already non-existent resources. And on May 29th, three people caught eating human flesh, young criminals ranging in age from 20 to 25, were arrested and taken to a nearby prison. Three other cannibals were arrested 2 days later, having admitted to killing a man and eating his liver and kidneys. For some reason, the authorities tried to downplay this by saying that though a dozen cases of cannibalism, yeah, had been reported, those who had done it had indulged, quote, by habit, because they had been cannibals for a long time. Yep, good old propaganda. No, they're just doing this because they like it. They like it. I mean, we could give them all the food they want, and they would still eat each other, because that's what these degenerates do. They fucking eat each other. I mean, come on. You know, they're landowners. That's what they do. Their cannibalism has nothing to do with any Soviet enforced starvation, obviously. Well, this was a convenient explanation for what was happening on Nizhino Island. Eyewitnesses would describe, fucking horrible atrocities. Oh my God. One of the things that eyewitnesses would describe was seeing women specifically, the poor women on this island were attacked, the most, it seems. They were savagely attacked by cannibals who cut off their breasts and calves, according to one report. As one eyewitness would say, on the island, there was a guard named Kostya Vinnikov, a young fellow. This is so ridiculous. Not ridiculous, this is just so evil. He fell in love with a girl who had been sent there and was courting her. He protected her. One day, he had to be away for a while, and he told one of his comrades, take care of her. But with all the people there, the comrade couldn't do much, really. People caught the girl, tied her to a poplar tree, cut off her breasts, her muscles, everything they could eat, everything. They were hungry. They had to eat. When Kostya came back, she was still alive. He tried to save her, but she had lost too much blood. That's like something out of a horror movie. She was still alive. After they tied her to a tree, cut off her breasts, cut off God knows what else, and were eating her. Many of these women died. Some of them survived. Of those who survived, several reportedly went mad after these traumatic attacks. Yeah, I bet. Can't imagine moving past that much trauma. I'm sure a lot of them were raped, a bunch too. Two of the testimonies in particular mentioned, quote, the wife of a communist leader whose breasts were cut off, and that was what finally got authorities to deal with the problem. My God. Some communist leader who had his wife ended up there. He was like, hey, guys, come on. Can we do something about the island? My wife got her tits cut off. And why were they so focused on eating breasts, by the way? Still higher ranking authorities simply concluded that the reports of cannibalism were overblown. Indeed, they were being spread by the deportees themselves to gain sympathy to work against the communist cause. And you know what? I bet a bunch of foreigners who ended up on the island, I bet they're there to stoke tensions and try and destroy the Soviet regime. This is actually what they were saying. The joy of living in a propaganda state. Right? If there's ever news you don't like, you just dismiss it. You just call it fake news. And you just keep right on doing your terrible shit. Sadly, it just fucking works like a charm. Now these assholes started arresting some deportees, not for cannibalism, but for spreading counter-revolutionary propaganda. Oh, such another common tactic of the propaganda state, right? Convince people that the truth is a lie and that lies are the truth. Corrode your citizens' perception of reality by consistently calling truth propaganda and by calling your actual propaganda truth. About 50 people would be arrested. They were fucking happy to trade the island of horror for a prison cell. And then many of them would end up, though, being quickly released, sent back to the island. 11 of them would be sentenced to death in July of 1933. At least one of the cannibals arrested would say, while waiting for his death sentence to be carried out, that waiting in a prison with a roof over his head and a bowl of hot broth to eat was way better than being on Nazino Island. Yeah. Meanwhile, of the 1,200 people who had arrived May 27th, many of them were suffering from typhus. Local authorities were worried in June of 1933 about a typhus outbreak. Who cares? Why would you be worried about a disease outbreak? Was it going to make things worse? I mean, things are bad right now. But if we let this typhus run rampant on the island, it's going to be a real horror show. When Commander Sepkov got back from his mission at the tail end of May, he was ordered to transfer, within 1 week, all of the deportees to, quote, appropriate places designated by the settlement plan, and to mobilize the area's residents to feed the deportees. He managed to mobilize about 20 usable boats, each of which could take a couple dozen people, to take the deportees to their, quote, final settlement sites. Five such sites were upriver, about 60 to 120 kilometers, or 37 to 74 miles from the island. Within 2 weeks, the island was almost completely emptied, and on June 12th, only about 157 deportees remained. Several hundred more deportees died during transfer, adding more numbers to the some 1,500 to 2,000 deaths that had occurred on the island and the hundreds who had escaped only to drown or starve. About 2,856 deportees were sent by boat to the upstream settlements, and when a count was made at the end of June, it confirmed that about half of the approximately 6,000 who had arrived on Nazino had disappeared or died. Now the survivors found themselves in a situation almost identical to the one they'd faced on the island, except now they were more or less left to their own devices. During this stage, a large number of deportees tried to escape on improvised rafts, but once again would perish when their rafts would sink or when they would be shot by guards, or they would just get lost and end up on shore and go off somewhere in the Siberian tundra and freeze to death or starve. In the meantime, word of what happened, and I guess they're not freezing to death. Well, no, they probably were freezing to death. They could freeze to death. They get hypothermia at night. In the meantime, word of what had happened in Nazino reached Siberia's highest political authorities. One of the officials at Nazino, Volosov, had decided to send a report to the big boss of Western Siberia, a dude named Robert Ica. It's funny to hear a Robert show up about what was going on, now dubbed the Nazino Affair. Better tell Bob that Shit's not going good in Nazino. The letter would arrive on June 10th. It would describe the utter failure of the plan, the chaos that had infected the island before deportees had been moved away. Even plans to remedy the situation had utterly failed, like when authorities managed to get some tools like axes to build shelters, but then didn't want to hand them out because they were afraid of arming insane, hungry cannibals with axes. That's fair. June 21st, a meeting was held by a commission of officials that arrived on site more than a month after the first passengers arrived on Nazino, and after most of them had already left. They decided that the number of 1,970 dead, there's probably way more than that, reported by health officials was, quote, grossly exaggerated for obvious political reasons. Fake news! I know that a lot of people saw these women get, like, chopped up and eaten, but that actually didn't happen. They're fucking people who just hate the Soviet Union. Mm-mm. No. Don't fall for Western lies. These people had a great time on the Siberian island. I mean, they didn't have to work. You know what? They were basically on vacation. Who doesn't love to go on an island vacation? Shut the fuck up. They're doing fine. The authorities proceeded to exhume and count the bodies in three graves, said that the grave diggers were also inclined to inflate the number of those who had died because they got more rations. They got more shitty-ass bread. If they buried more bodies, you can't trust a greedy-ass grave digger. Then they went up the river to settlement number one. As the official record would describe it, a virgin space along the river, a primitive clay oven, rude huts made with pine branches under which the D-class A elements refused to take shelter, preferring to gather in the open around wood fires. A single wooden hut, just the way they write it. They got perfectly good shelters of sticks, but they're just being dicks and they don't want to stay inside of them. A single wooden hut, which serves as lodging for the commander and the guards, the contingent consists of the most D-class A elements of the cities, truly the refuse of society. They all proudly advertise the fact that they come from Moscow or Leningrad. They are all extremely dirty. Oh, yeah, you think? Lice-ridden, emaciated, without shoes, yeah, dressed in rags, of course. Some of them are naked. Since they have been there, it is clear that none of them has washed. And despite the fine weather that has now come, none of these elements wants to bathe in the river. When they saw us coming, the D-Class A's gathered together and began demanding that they be released, each one claiming that he had been exiled here for no good reason. Most of these elements, won't even call them humans, most of these elements refused to work, despite the commander's injunctions. We'd rather die than work, the boldest said openly. In any case, we've been brought here so that we'll die of hunger. We'll run away, that doesn't scare us. I made a speech telling them that those who went to work would get increased rations along with tobacco and clothing, and eventual liberation as well, while those who refused to work would receive only the minimal rations. As for those who tried to escape, they would be referred to the OGPU's Troika. I hate to admit that very few reacted positively to my speech. Most of them are incorrigible. The rare individuals who agree to work do so slowly and carelessly. These people suck. None of them are smiling. None of them are fucking whistling. They didn't offer me a hug. They didn't tell me how great Soviet Union is. They're all fucking, oh, I'm sad. Oh, I had to fucking, my wife got eaten. Boo, boo-hoo. Oh, they cut her breasts off right in front of me. Boo. God, the rationalization of just whoever wrote that. And people do that shit all the time, right? They just twist the truth to make themselves look and feel so much better than they should. Right? If you believe these deportees had done nothing to deserve this, they're just, you know, poor humans getting fucked over by a tyrannical regime, well, you're probably going to, you know, feel terrible if you have at least a shred of a conscience. But you'll feel so much better if you just paint them as just nothing but incorrigible parasites, the dregs of society, enemies of the state who deserve whatever terrible fate they have been allotted. Don't even want to hear their story. Fuck them. They did that shit to themselves. That's such an easy way to go through life, right? Anything bad happens to people around you? Well, fuck them then. They're not me. I'm doing good. One of humanity's greatest strengths is it has to be just our ability to lie to ourselves. Just convince ourselves that black is white, or white is black, you know, whatever's just the most morally convenient. One of these people shouted, "You're starving the people. We're eating one another." That person and 14 or so other hotheads were arrested. My God. What did he say? They're eating each other? Arrest them. Some of the people in charge of all this were punished by the people above them who had created the situation, a situation destined to fail. That was very Soviet. Commander Sepkov, stripped of his responsibilities, received a severe censure to be recorded in his personal party membership file, according to a report. It was then decided to transport the deportees once again to new settlement sites near the confluence of the Bab and the Xena Rivers, as the sites that Sepkoff had chosen were now inaccessible by boat because the water levels had dropped too much. Now the plan was to create a utopian prospective economic plan for developing the resources of the district in 1933. Nothing about the Soviet Union was ever utopian. I love it. It's like, listen, I know this is shit now. I know this is like been an island where a lot of people got their tits cut off and eaten and just starved and were crawling around. You know, they're 100 years old and just, you know, fucking asking for a little bit of flour to be poured in their shoe as they shit themselves to death. But pretty soon, it's going to be utopia. Before the year was up, the deportees were expected to have cleared 500 hectares, sowed them in rye, accumulated sufficient reserves of wood for construction and heating, gathered enough fish, berries, and mushrooms to last winter. That's reasonable. These starving, traumatized, maimed people. Oh, yeah, they should be able to easily do that. After this meeting, the district authorities left. They left a new commander, Commander Frolov, in charge. And he actually did get to work. In a few weeks, he located a crew of construction workers, had them build an actual settlement village where the remaining survivors from site number one, about 250 people, began to live in mid-July. But Frolov had no time to transfer approximately 2,000 survivors who were living further upriver in sites 2 to 5. Also had to deal with some additional 4,200 individuals now on their way from Tromsk to Nizhino. They were mainly large numbers of elderly and disabled people, along with women and small children, who had, according to a report, no value in terms of economic development, and whose presence in cities turned them into, quote, garbage can zones. Let's get these garbage can kids out of here. Three such convoys would arrive between the end of June and July 18th, uploading about 100 kilometers or about 62 miles upstream from Nizhino. According to Frolov, this round went a lot better because the deportees received buckwheat soup, 500 grams of actual bread, and after 2 or 3 days, some dried fish. And since they had a public bathhouse now, typhus, not as much of an issue. Only 23 people died in the first few days. Only 23 of these fucking garbage can kids. What a win. After a week on the island, these deportees were also sent to their, quote, final resettlement sites. Apparently no one got their tits cut off. Big step up. But most of them did refuse to work and tried to escape. According to the master plan laid out just a few months before, in February, after those deportees passed through, the rest of the year would see a total of 200,000 deportees pass through this area on their way to resettlement zones if they survived Cannibal Island. But then that would not happen. That was the plan, but then the plan was scrapped because Vasily Velechko, a young journalist slash propagandist, that was all that existed in the Soviet Union, had started looking into what had happened on the island. He would spend nearly 3 weeks on the island trying to figure out what had happened, if the reports of the massive success of resettlement to Western Siberia were actually true. When he completed his report, he sent it to his immediate superior, Levitz, the secretary of the party committee of the Naryam region, and also, fuck, he sent it to Bob. He sent it to Bob Ica, and to Stalin himself. That was pretty bold for a 25-year-old bureaucrat, but it was actually something Stalin encouraged. He thought it was good for people to go above the heads of their managers because he thought that upper-level managers usually just gave him flattering or good news that wasn't always true. Velechko denounced the, quote, series of errors and causes of negligence that had led to, quote, stunning collapse of a great project for the colonization of a Siberian region. He described in detail what had happened from the deportees' arrival to their evacuation. He laid the blame on local officials who had no idea what to do with the people they'd been given, couldn't even help them once they were in the permanent settlements as people continued to die at a rapid rate. By August 20th, he reported barely 2,200 people remained alive out of the 6,600 to 6,800 who had arrived from Tomsk. This horror show had only begun a little over 2 months before in May, right? So much atrocity in such little time. Velechko said that some of these people who had died or were still suffering there were party members or relatives of party members who had been unfairly detained by lazy officials. They had asked Velechko to help them while he was investigated, and now he was. He would be the first person to ever report their grievances to any kind of higher official. His letter to Stalin would arrive in Moscow in the beginning of September of 1933. Stalin read it, immediately requested that it be circulated amongst the members of the Politburo. On September 23rd, the Politburo assigned a high official to look into the matter who started a commission that would end up visiting several settlement villages, all of them in a terrible state of dilapidation that contradicted official reports. According to one document, the huts are half buried. A roof made of branches through which the autumn rains pour. No windows. Inside, rows of pallets, with a little dry grass to serve as a blanket. Half-naked, emaciated, dirty, lice-ridden individuals lying there. Outside the huts, the more vigorous ones warmed themselves around wood fires. When the local commander was asked, why did the deportees stay outside? He replied, all the D-Class-A's, right, the undesirables, are used to living around wood fires. They've always done that. That's just how these people live. They're urchins. They're forest elves. He said, they do it here too. We also went to the huts into which had been crowded people suffering from dysentery, tuberculosis, scurvy, and syphilis, along with severely emaciated individuals. They were all lying on pallets covered with a blanket of grass that hadn't been changed for weeks, that emitted a pestilential odor of manure. When we asked, why are these individuals in such a state? We were told they had always been sick. What is happening with these people? They just say the dumbest shit. Oh, what's going on here? Why are these people sick on these pallets? Oh, that's how they've always been. They were born that way. They fell out of their mom's vagina, landed right on a pallet, and they're a pallet creature. They're a pallet slug. They look like a human, but that's actually a pallet slug. What the fuck? Fucking Russia is so fucking weird. God. When we asked, why are these individuals in such a state? We were told they'd always been sick and emaciated, and that in any case, they cannot be cared for because there was a lack of everything. We estimated that there were at least 800 bedridden sick people. A few rare, able-bodied individuals were constantly bustling about building huts. At one settlement site, the commission noticed a piece of land that had been cleared and sown about one hectare in area. It was obvious. All of this had been a colossal failure. Therefore, the commission recommended that the case of the survivors be, quote, rapidly re-examined, lest the least socially dangerous ones leave, forbidding them to reside in cities subject to special rules, to send the more dangerous ones back to Tomsk camp, at least until spring, and completely evacuate all the sites where the deportees in the 1933 contingent had been installed. On November 1st, Robert Ika, fucking Bobby, Bob met with his officials, Russian Bobby, met with his officials, agreed to sanction about 10 who had been in some way involved with the Nazino affair. Both Sepkov and Frolov would be expelled from the party now and sentenced to up to 3 years in a fucking gulag in a camp for having, quote, sabotaged the implementation of the state's 1933 plan for colonizing the Narim region. So they were set up to fail and then scapegoated, which is also just so Soviet. But the committee did concede that the contingents of deportees were completely unsuited for colonizing the Siberian Great North. And they instructed the party's central committee not to send any further contingents to Western Siberia. As a result, the Nazino atrocity directly led to the end of large-scale settlement plans in the Soviet Union and to the end of using deportees from urban D-Class A elements and criminal backgrounds for future settlement plans. But of course, the Soviet government would never admit that they had fucked up massively. So, that would make them look bad. So they just didn't admit that. Velichko's report would remain classified until the human rights organization called Memorial would conduct an investigation in 1998, over 5 decades after these events. And the tragedy was not finally made public knowledge until 2002, when reports from a September 1933 special commission by the Communist Party were published by Memorial. Today, Nazino, much the same as it was, before this happened, and actually a little ways afterwards, a swampy island in the middle of a river in a sparsely settled, far-flung, desolate region of Russia. Except today, different sites commemorate the victims of the Nazino tragedy, and every June, a ceremony is held both on the island and in the town of Nazino in honor of the victims, people whose last moments on Earth may have been amongst the most terrifying any person could possibly experience. And all of that was government sanctioned. All of it was legal, right? Nice reminder that legal does not always equate to good or fair or ethical. I hate when people, just get real fucking anal and it's like, well, I shouldn't have broke the law. Well, sometimes laws suck and people should break them. Sometimes they're unethical. So glad the Soviet Union fell. What an incredibly shitty political experiment. Now if somebody could just please fucking kill Putin. Please die, Putin. Please, you motherfucker, just die. So that Russia can move in a more humanist direction. That would be awesome. Or I guess, he could die and it could go the other way. If that evil snake gets his head cut off, what other monster might rise up to sit on his throne? But also, maybe somebody good could show up, finally hold the reins over there. If Putin could be eliminated, hopefully painfully and slowly, Could Russia, for maybe the first time ever, see the formation of a new kind of government that does not exploit and abuse and oppress its many beautiful people? Such resilient people to endure all that. Such a perpetual shame that they have to endure it. Now, we live in such a beautiful world that actually does have enough resources for all of us to be able to live comfortable lives, you know, away from tyranny. But our world always has, you know, a certain amount of terrible, greedy, small-minded, selfish fuckfaces living in it who just bully their way through life and create so much needless suffering for those around them. And for what? So they can continue on with their never-ending, misguided quest for fulfillment. So they can fight for more and more power in a futile attempt to fill the deep fucking hole inside of them that more power will never, ever fill. I wish I could force literally every able-bodied person in the world to smoke enough weed. I guess you don't have to be able-bodied to smoke weed. I wish I could force everybody over the age of about, I don't know, 16, to smoke enough weed, take enough magic mushrooms and Molly, undergo enough fucking therapy. Until they finally felt, you know, a decent amount of empathy and experienced enough ego death to see what a hollow way to live this is. My experiment might not work, but at the very least, holy shit, it'd be a great party. Be the party to end all parties. You know, none of us are here for very long. We don't actually have to use our limited time to fuck over others to get enough for ourselves. Hopefully one day, collectively, humanity will understand that, and stories like these will be read and or heard by shocked and appalled people from a better world way in the future, people who just can't wrap their heads around what the fuck was wrong with us. And that's it for this edition of Time Sucks, Short Sucks. God, whenever I feel like, I don't know, frustrated with something, I should just tell myself, well, at least you're not alive in Soviet Russia. Please, you're not living back in Soviet Russia. Woo! If you enjoyed this story, check out the rest of the Bad Magic Productions catalog. Beefier episodes of Time... What did I just say? Beefier? Episodes of Time Suck every Monday at noon Pacific time. New episodes of the now long-running paranormal podcast, Scared to Death, every Tuesday at midnight. Two episodes of Nightmare Fuel. Some fictional horror. None of my words sound right after this. Thrown into the mix each month. Thanks to Sophie Evans for her initial research on this one. Thanks to Logan Keith. Polishing up the sound of today's episode, making that cool episode thumbnail art. Please go to badmagicproductions.com for porn. We don't have porn. Not yet. Who knows what the future holds? I don't have any plans for porn there. But we do have merch and stuff and, like, you know, I don't know, ringtones, other stuff. So check that out and have yourself a great weekend.
Bad Magic Productions.